Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Well, it is 2019, and that means that 50 years ago this summer, we landed on the moon. I mean, the collective we in terms of the United States of America. And I remember that being an immensely big deal. I still remember being rather sick. I know I had a sore throat, could have been strep throat. All I know is I was pretty much down for the count. Nonetheless, I was still in front of the TV watching the landing and being just as inspired as pretty much everybody else. Well, when we think of space travel, some of us think purely in scientific terms, some in sociological terms, and some in spiritual terms. It just so happened that not long ago, I was in an airport in Florida, and I ran into Professor Dina Weibel. Now, Dina is a longtime colleague, and we had a wonderful conversation about the work that she's doing right now, which involves spirituality and space travel. So as we were conversing in the airport, I said, "This sounds like a perfect conversation to be had on Common Threads." And so she is here today. Let me tell you a little bit about Professor Weibel. She is a cultural anthropologist here at Grand Valley State University, whose work focuses primarily on religion, especially the topics of pilgrimage and sacred space. Her main field work takes place in France at pilgrimage sites venerating the Virgin Mary. Other research interests include religious cognition, sacred objects, religion and space travel, as we just mentioned, and the role of anthropology and her own family in the ethnological displays of Philippine tribal peoples at fairs and carnivals in the 1900s. She is advising faculty for the Grand Valley State Religious Studies Program and a board member here at the Interfaith Dialogue Association. So we welcome Dina Weibel. Hi, Dina.
Hi, Fred. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Definitely.
So tell us a bit about how you first translated space travel into a spiritual experience. When did it hit you? And I'm assuming that your work in pilgrimage sites, especially in Europe, might have been a springboard.
Well, it was actually before I really got into anthropological research at all. In graduate school, when I was considering different topics, pilgrimage was one of them. I was very interested, especially in what it was like to be a community, living in a community that was next to a sacred place, and how that would affect the community itself. But I was also very interested in sort of the religious lives of scientists. It has always seemed to me that religion can be understood in a lot of different ways, but one way is that it offers a framework for understanding reality. So if you are coming through the world with a religious perspective, that provides kind of a lens for you to interpret what's going on around you. As you know, the scientific method also provides a lens, and I'm really interested in what happens when there's a combining of different lenses. So if you're seeing something from two perspectives at once, how does that work? Do you have to change your perspective, go back and forth? Is there a way to blend those perspectives? Do you abandon one of the perspectives in favor of the other? And I remember being in graduate school and actually writing to Ira Flatow of Science Friday, asking him to do a program on the religious beliefs of astronauts. And he sent me a nice note back, and I don't know if they ever followed up on it. But that would have been in the mid-90s, I would think.
It's interesting because I recently read something. It was written by a Muslim philosopher scholar on the so-called God particle, the Higgs boson particle. And his thesis is that The Higgs boson is a fabulous discovery, but it's not the God particle.
Right.
And he is a theist, but he doesn't go, aha, we have guaranteed proof of God because we've got the God particle. And he's saying the people who do that are ridiculous, and he gives plenty of great reasoning why. And he also states in there that the scientists who have been involved in the discovery of the Higgs boson. The ones who were theists maintain being theists, mm-hmm. and the ones who were not converted. So you have this bias going into whatever research you're involved in, either, you know, theism or not, or if not theism, at least some spiritual worldview, because mm-hmm. theism is a particular spiritual worldview, as we know. I'm wondering, after all of the interviews, all of the research that you have done, does that tend to be the case?
I would say for scientists whose work is connected to space exploration in an indirect way, so scientists who are not themselves going up into space, I do see something of a continuation of whatever belief system they started with. I have heard from quite a few scientists. I was at the NASA Human Research Program Investigators Workshop in Galveston, Texas this past January, and did hear several stories from scientists who started out as religious kids, mostly, in religious families, and told me sort of the story of them leaving religion behind. Interestingly, when I was at the Vatican Observatory studying the Jesuit astronomers there in Vatican, it's a section of Vatican City that's not in Vatican City, so it's kind of like, you know, an American embassy is considered American territory.
Yes.
In Castel Gandolfo, they have a section of Italy that's considered Vatican territory, and that's where the Pope's summer palace is, and also where four observatories are, and the whole setup for the Vatican Observatory and the astronomers who work for them. And several of the Italian astronomers I spoke to had an interesting story where they started out coming from religious families, began to question their religious beliefs as they learned more about science, then reached out to other members of the clergy and were brought back into the fold, whereupon they became both Jesuits and PhDs in the sciences. And so that was an interesting kind of like two tracks of two different stories, the way it could turn out. But a lot of people who are religious and active in science and space exploration have definitely maintained their religious beliefs.
At the observatory, I want you to talk a little bit about your experience there, because that was part of our conversation at the airport. Mm-hmm. How did you end up there?
It sounds like
it would be a fun, with big air quotes around it, but a cool place to be.
It was a very cool place to be. I got there through combining several interests and leveraging human contacts, if that sounds kind of weird. But anyway, the short version is, one of the things I do here in Grand Rapids is I'm a co-organizer of an event called Roger That, which is an annual celebration of space exploration in honor of Grand Rapids native Roger B. Chaffee. He was killed in the Apollo 1 explosion, along with Gus Grissom and Ed White. But since he's a hometown boy, we decided to mark the 50th anniversary by doing that. One of our first speakers was Guy Consolmagno, who's currently the director of the Vatican Observatory. He was sort of a friend of a friend of a couple friends. And so I was able to reach out to him, bring him here. He came and gave two talks for us during that event. And I maintained contact with him, eventually saying, you know, would it be possible for me to go out to the Vatican Observatory and do some ethnographic research as an anthropologist? And he first said, oh, sure, maybe about a week. As I kept contacting him and talking to him, that became 4 weeks. So I was there from mid-March to mid-April this past year.
And tell us what your daily life was usually like there.
One of the jokes that
Shopping on Via Veneto.
They weren't in Rome. We were in kind of a small town. If anybody's familiar with Albano Laziale, that's kind of where we were. Next to this beautiful large lake, which is known either as Lake Albano or Lake Gandolfo, depending on which your alliance is there. And it's a former convent. So the observatory used to be located on the palace grounds of the Pope's summer palace. The current Pope, Francis I, doesn't really use the summer palace. The old observatory was kind of creaky and built in, you know, the 1600s. And so they moved them right around 2008, I believe, to a former convent. And it's a very modern building, mostly because the area was bombed out during World War II. The lower floors are the offices. It looks a lot like visiting a university and the faculty offices. Each one of these guys, and they're all guys except for some adjuncts, have an office. They have a meteorite lab. They have a museum that's nearby. They have a lot of interesting displays, a classroom, and administrative offices. And on that same floor is an apartment for guests. And it can hold a lot more guests than one. I was lucky. I was the only person interested in it for the time period. So I would literally get up in the morning, get some breakfast, and then they met every morning at 10 o'clock for cappuccino in the coffee room. And that would be the first part of the day. I would hang out in the library. I would be sometimes invited to eat with them, attend religious services with them. A lot of times I was just going into their offices and talking to them about their research. Occasionally there would be a tour that they would do, either just for me or, for instance, a group from Cork, Ireland came in, an astronomy group, to tour the observatory, and I tagged along on that. But it was mostly just what anthropologists call participant observation. You settle into a place and you spend time there doing what the locals do. I was occasionally invited upstairs, which is where their dormitories are. Not into the dormitories, but into the kitchen, into the dining room.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yes. And they actually have sort of a game room on the top floor that they converted from an outdoor patio into an indoor place to sit and talk and play board games and things like that. So it's a very relaxed atmosphere. One of the jokes was, if this is poverty, I want to see what celibacy looks like. That wasn't my joke.
I understand.
But they're doing some amazing
Jesuits
science.
Jesuits don't take the vow of poverty. You probably found that out.
Jesuits are their own breed, definitely.
Yes.
And they run a summer school every other year where they bring in, it's a completely secular summer school. They bring in students, no more than two from each country, and teach them astronomy with some of the great experts, such as, I can't think of her name right now, but the woman who discovered the concept of dark matter. She was one of their instructors.
And why does the Catholic Church have this wonderful observatory?
There are a couple stories. One of them, who's the vice director, mentioned this to me. It's a nation state. And nations during the medieval times, you had astronomers. And so if the king of England is going to have an astronomer, the pope is going to have an astronomer. It was just kind of how it worked. That being said, it was sort of renovated and brought back right around the start of the 20th century again, sort of brought into more prominence. And one of the goals is just very directly to prove that science can be done alongside religious belief, that the two ideas are not incompatible and, in fact, are incredibly compatible. And that's kind of a lot of the perspective that I obtained through these interviews, was that science is what the Jesuits do. Catholicism has been the source of many amazing Catholic ideas. That it's ridiculous to think that science and religion are opposed, because they're constantly doing real science, working on NASA projects, publishing in different papers, journal articles, books. They're proving that they can be priests and brothers and also scientists.
And so there are no lay members. Everyone there is a priest?
There are a couple of them that are brothers, which means that they are Jesuits, but they haven't become priests.
Understand.
So they have to take the same vows, but they don't have the same rights and responsibilities.
Right. They don't say mass.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There are adjunct members who are sometimes priests who aren't Jesuits. Actually, there's a regular one who's not a Jesuit. But I know some of the adjuncts are very religious Catholic professors from American universities, including women, for instance.
And you would assume that being Catholic is a requirement to be a part of this?
I don't think they require you to be Catholic to do research there. I know for sure that you don't have to be Catholic to do research there. But to have an official position, thinking that everybody I met there was Catholic, and I'm going over in my mind who was listed on the adjunct list, and I didn't meet everybody, but the ones I did meet were Catholic.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and my guest today is Professor Dina Weibel. She's a professor of anthropology here at Grand Valley State University, and we're talking about spirituality and space. One of the articles that you shared with me recounted a story I remember hearing years ago, and it had to do with Yuri, the first cosmonaut, mm-hmm. and a ritual that he started. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. It's quite a fascinating story. Not just the fact that what he did in the establishment of a ritual, because he didn't know he was establishing a ritual, mm-hmm. but the fact that it turned into a ritual up to this day.
Okay. This is a fun story, and people enjoy hearing about it. Yuri Gagarin, of course, as most of your listeners will know, was the first human being to go into space. And as probably most of us would be if we were going to be the first human to go into space, you get nervous, especially when you're on your way to the launching pad. He felt the call of nature, asked them to pull the bus over, got out of the bus, and relieved himself on the left back tire of the bus. Got back in, was launched into space, successful. Yay. Congratulations to everyone. One of the article I shared with you was one in which Glenn Swanson, who was my co-author, and I were talking or evaluating the different ways that religion and a lack of religion might manifest in different space programs. The American space program has always had kind of a religious strain through it. During the years of the Soviet Union, you weren't able to be openly religious as a member of the Soviet space program. This was, you know, under communism, where atheism was the order of the day. There have been some theories from anthropology that indicate when people have control over a situation, they just stick to science. But when they are in situations where control's a little dicey, there's some psychological anxiety happening. That's where people will turn to religion, to pray for guidance, for instance, to pray for help, to meditate. But magical thinking is a similar idea where you are doing things to improve your situation that aren't necessarily rational. So getting back to Yuri, Yuri urinated on the back of the tire. The next cosmonaut to go up wanted to make sure that everything worked okay, and so followed everything that Yuri did, including stopping and urinating on that left back tire. That became a tradition in the Soviet Union, and now that it's Russia to this day, where people who are going up into space with the Soviet or Russian program, whether or not they were cosmonauts, they could be American astronauts, it became this tradition to urinate on the left back tire on the way there. You might be wondering about women. Women would often bring a vial of urine with them to sprinkle on the left back tire. So this becomes, I guess you could call it a superstition, but it's also probably an enjoyable, fun bonding thing. And it also relieves some of that anxiety, knowing that you're following the successful steps that worked before.
Oh, you're relieving more than that.
Yes.
And of course, we don't know that there isn't a causal relationship.
That's
now,
true.
Do we?
We don't.
I mean, have all of the explorations, have they been successful?
They haven't all been successful. There have been a few Soviet launches that didn't, well, launches mostly went well. There was one time where there was an oxygen link and some cosmonauts returning from space came down, and it looked like a perfect landing, and everybody had died of asphyxiation on the way down. That was during the Apollo years. There was a recent flight that was to go in 2018 that was aborted and then rescheduled, and the latest launch was sort of a rescheduling of that with a third person added. I'm sure it doesn't guarantee success, but it certainly makes people feel better. And I will say that there are very similar things. I was touring the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in March, and there are a lot of superstitions and magical thinking that goes on there. For instance, peanuts. Apparently, eating peanuts, passing around peanuts, is something that they do to assure success, and that's become a thing. And there's a lot of signage up about it and a lot of discussion about peanuts. It's sort of their part of who they are as an entity.
Sure. And what about overt religious gestures?
In contemporary times or historically?
Historically and up until now, whatever your research has indicated.
Well, what I'm finding is that a lot of times contemporary, I've interviewed several sort of contemporary astronauts. Most of them are retired. Some religious, some not. The ones that are religious have definitely included their religiosity as part of what they were doing in space. So, for instance, and I'm going to follow anthropological convention and not use real names, but one of the astronauts that I've interviewed, who I refer to as Tom in my research, he is an evangelical Christian astronaut, very religiously devout, definitely brought up Bibles with him, definitely read the Bible on a regular basis, and he ran a Sunday school in Houston and was one of the teachers there. And when he was in the space station, he actually conducted Sunday school classes over the intercom or over the communication device with his students while he was orbiting space. Mm. And so I would say that's pretty overt.
That's pretty overt.
One of the more famous astronauts who has been sort of publicly on the record with this is Shannon Lucid. That's her real name. She is an astronaut, retired now, who was born in a concentration camp. Her parents were missionaries, Christian missionaries during World War II, and they were captured and sent to a Chinese prison camp by the Japanese. And so she was born there, very strong evangelical tradition. When she went up into one of the earlier pre-International Space Stations, probably the Mir, with cosmonauts, she brought several tapes from her pastor that were intended on proselytizing to the cosmonauts.
How'd that go over?
I have not heard it from their perspective. I found some articles from her hometown paper talking about how excited they were to be sending these up and the pastor encouraging them to, you know, follow God's word and notice what the Bible's described about space and how the earth hangs in space. And I feel like it's kind of a closed space if somebody's proselytizing to you. You can't really leave.
Well, you could, but it's,
yeah,
it's
maybe
difficult.
Not. You'd have to really want to leave. But yeah, that there's some kind of overt religiosity.
I'm curious was there any diplomatic blowback? You know, you have these two governments working together, and did you ever read anything of any issues?
I haven't. I do know that during one of Shannon Lucid's, this isn't what you asked, but during one of Shannon Lucid's missions, and I'm trying to learn more about this, she was sent up with a Saudi Arabian prince who, his own particular cultural perspective, was not inclined to see her as an equal member of the crew, and she felt very strongly about that, from what I was told, and had to be very strongly convinced to go to Saudi Arabia to meet with his family after the mission was completed as sort of a ceremonial thing. She didn't want to go, but she did. This is what I was told. So I'm doing some research into getting more records of that. I don't think there was as much concern. I think during the era when the Soviet Union was still the Soviet Union, there was more of a hands-off feeling. I think after the wall fell and religion sort of came back to Russia, there was definitely more of a sense that it was okay to talk about religion again, and it was okay to bring up religion as a topic at that point.
Sure. I remember a Hindu woman, a Hindu astronaut, and I know she did something religious. I can't. Did she?
Williams?
Huh?
Was it Sunita Williams?
Yeah.
I know she brought a statue of Ganesh. That
was it.
Into space, and she's the subject of another thing that I'm trying to learn more about. And I found this to be really fascinating. There is a persistent rumor on the internet, especially in Islamic countries, that she converted to Islam while orbiting over Mecca. And she denies it. It's not something that she says happened. But it's interesting to see that that's a story that gets told. And I only found out, honestly, doing research yesterday, that there are similar rumors that Neil Armstrong converted to Islam while in space. So I'm going to track down what this whole thing means, what this sort of belief in someone else's conversion because of them going into space. And that was one of the things you mentioned was at the top that scientists don't tend to change their mind. I will say there have been several astronauts who've had conversion experiences or could be described as a deepening of their religion or a change in their religious perspective while they were in space.
Well, that's something we can talk about next week.
Okay.
So my last question is, the articles that you sent me, are they available to the public?
I do have an Academia EDU page. So if you go to academia.edu, it's a service where a lot of academics can upload their work. GVSU, I believe, has some access, but Academia EDU would probably be the place where most of my articles could be available for download. It's kind of open access.
And if anybody has any challenge navigating that, if you go to our website, interfaithdialogueassociation.org, and use that email address that's on our homepage, we'll make sure that you get what you're looking for. Dina, it was great having you here, and I look forward to wrapping this up next week.
Thank you so much, Fred.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Professor Dina Weibel has been my guest, and we will continue our conversation next week. Please join us here on WGVU.